This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Even if you're not counting on Social Security to be there when you need it, the news today was distressing. As the recession cuts away at the labor pool and the tax base, the retirement numbers just don't add up. Never mind about paying for medical care. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media brings you four documentaries about the economic crisis, supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 12th of May. Great to have you with us. We have been hearing for years now that Social Security is in trouble, that the retirement trust fund is going to collapse under the weight of the wave of baby boomers that's about to hit it. At a once-in-several-generations economic slowdown, the prognosis doesn't get any better. The trustees of the Social Security and Medicare programs issued their annual report today. Social Security is going to run out of money by 2037. That's 4 years earlier than the most recent forecast. And projections for Medicare are even worse, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
Medicare already spends more than payroll taxes take in, and the health care trust fund runs out in 2017, 2 years earlier than the trustees reported last year. Today, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said Medicare's financial challenges are larger and more imminent than Social Security's.
Medicare faces demographic challenges, rapidly growing health care costs, and the short-term outlook has been hurt by the recession.
The choices for Congress are stark. Either raise taxes on both employees and employers, the traditional way the programs are paid for, or cut benefits. David John at the Heritage Foundation says raising payroll taxes would probably increase unemployment. Currently, he says companies pay just over 7% of a worker's salary into both programs.
If you increase that from, say, 7% to 8%, that worker becomes more expensive to the employer, and the employer is much more likely to start to explore replacing that worker with a machine or something like that.
Fixing Medicare's finances depends on reducing overall medical costs for retirees. Social Security will continue to build up a surplus until 2017, and that will last until 2037.
It's three decades out there.
Barbara Canelli with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says there's still time to save Social Security, and Treasury Secretary Geithner promised the Obama administration will do that after they solve health care. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ford took advantage of a recent rally in its stock price to raise more money today, sold close to 300 million new shares, hoping to net about $2 billion that it's going to use to buy back some of its debt. Ford's not the only company selling big chunks of stock these days. Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, and U.S. Bancorp are just a couple of the banks that have hit up the markets for cash. And so far, investors are biting. But new share offerings aren't necessarily a win for everybody. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
When a company like Ford wants to raise money, it hires an investment bank, or maybe several. The bankers then go out and find investors to buy the stock. Not that you and I are likely getting any calls. Richard Sparks is an analyst with Schaefer's Investment Research. He says bankers are mostly seeking big investors like pension funds and money managers willing to gamble on Ford.
People are just simply betting that it will be the survivor among U.S. automakers, and that when things turn around and when the economy gets better, that stock will be higher as well.
Investors are also betting on banks. Larry Gelman is a financial advisor with Robert W. Baird & Company. He says even after the stress tests, it's hard to know just how healthy the banks are, and investors chance buying into a short-lived rally.
All these factors make it pretty clear that people who invest at this level, whether they're individuals or institutions, are taking on a good deal of risk.
Stock offerings can also hurt existing shareholders. Jay Ritter teaches finance at the University of Florida. He says 300 million new shares dilute Ford's ownership.
Consequently, the profits per share that Ford will hopefully be earning in the future are going to be spread out among more shareholders.
The sure winners are the big investment banks. They'll rake in commissions, in some cases for selling each other's stock. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There has been a movement the past couple of years of consumers seeking out foods that are grown closer to where they live. But don't necessarily take our word for it. Even the giant Frito-Lay company is trying to cash in on the trend. A new marketing campaign unveiled today pitches Lay's potato chips as locally made. Joel Rose reports not everybody's buying it.
So I've got a bag of Lay's potato chips here at my office in Philadelphia. And to find out where they came from, I'm going to find the product code on the bag, type it into the new chip tracker on the Lay's website. Okay, and it looks like my bag of chips was made in Kirkwood in upstate New York.
Consumers have become increasingly interested in where their food comes from, where it's grown, where it's made.
That's not a spokesman for the local foods movement. It's Dave Skeena, Vice President of Potato Chip Marketing for Frito-Lay.
We weren't sure if we were getting our story out enough about all the farms across the country, the 80 farms in 27 states where we do grow potatoes for Lay's potato chips.
To correct that, Lay's has commissioned a handful of TV ads starring real farmers like brothers Brian and Gary Walther.
Next time you grab a bag of Lay's in Michigan.
Michigan.
Think of us.
On the one hand, it's a sign of progress, but on the other hand, it completely misses the point.
Jessica Prentice is a local foods activist and author in Northern California. She says the movement towards eating local is about more than just geography.
It's also about how is it raised? How is the soil treated? And then it's also about who raised it? And, you know, who am I supporting with this dollar that I'm spending?
Despite the new ad campaign, Prentice says most of Lay's potatoes are grown on big industrial farms, exactly what local eaters are trying to avoid. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Traders turned in a split decision on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. With consumers being purposefully tight with a buck in the middle of a recession, the advertising industry is an ugly business right now, especially for copywriters. Targeted online ads have collided with the Great Recession to wipe out more than 32,000 traditional advertising jobs in the past year. Marketplace's Steve Henn found an ad guy for whom the old line about desperate times calling for desperate measures really applies.
At a going-away party for colleagues who'd just been canned, ad man Lawson Clark thought he was fine.
Like an idiot, I was going around hugging everybody, saying, "Don't worry, it's fine. I've been laid off twice before, once by my own father, so it doesn't get any worse than that."
The next day, the head of HR dropped the axe. So Clark did the only thing any self-respecting ad executive could do. He put together a website featuring himself sprawled on a bearskin rug.
It's Burt Reynolds' famous pose in Cosmopolitan.
Naked.
Oh, well, all right then.
Pam Murtaugh is a marketing consultant.
That is interesting.
A 70s era portable TV doubles as a fig leaf while displaying Clark's work. Catchy male-oriented spots like this one for Bob's cut-rate men's clothes.
Men all over Europe are wearing capri pants.
Capri pants.
Clark took a similar approach to selling himself. But I asked Pam Murtaugh if this strategy was really the best way to go.
Well, It depends on your goal of marketing yourself. If his goal is to market himself as the voice of the guy, he's done it in spades.
She says he's got it down when it comes to marketing ironic macho to young men. But Clark's former employer did a lot of work for companies like Hershey's. And marketing executive Adam Hampt says ad agencies want writers who target women, too. They control roughly 80% of all consumer purchases. So
it's not looking great for him, but he might want to consider, you know, relocating to Russia or Eastern Europe, where this kind of male-centric approach still has a lot of runway ahead of it.
Still, Clark's body of work has gotten him a mention in Ad Age and 250,000 web hits last week.
Would it get him hired? I don't know. But man, it's worth a laugh. And right now, everybody needs that.
You've reached Lawson Clark, male copywriter.
Leave a message. He'll get back to you. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Court-appointed trustee handling the liquidation of Bernie Madoff's assets filed yet another lawsuit today. He's trying to get back some of what Madoff's clients lost in that multi-billion-dollar Ponzi scheme Madoff was running. As investors try to figure out how to recoup some of their losses, others are asking how Madoff got away with it for so long. One reason is that investors were often held at arm's length. They could only get into a Madoff fund through what are called, logically enough, feeder funds. Those funds fed investors money to Madoff, but allowed for some distance between the sucker and the con man. Tonight on PBS, Frontline has a new look at the Madoff affair, including an interview with one of Madoff's original feeders, a guy named Michael Bienes. I asked Frontline correspondent Martin Smith earlier today to explain how Bienes and his accounting partner Frank Avellino got involved with Madoff in the first place.
Well, Madoff gets out of college in 1960 and marries his high school sweetheart, Ruth Alpern, and then he gets a desk at his father-in-law, Saul Alpern's accounting firm, and he meets these two guys there. They're accountants working for his father-in-law, and he says to them, look, you guys can get me clients. We'll invest the money, and we'll give these people these returns.
And it was all incredibly secret, too. I mean, one of the passages in the show from this evening is that this guy, Michael Bienes, hid his involvement with Madoff from almost everybody. Let's roll that tape.
I never used his name. Never used his name. To me, it was like the secret name of God. It wouldn't even when we had the business, I tried not to use his name.
Would it have mattered if he had gone around and said, hey, I'm working for Bernie Madoff?
Well, nobody would have known who Bernie Madoff was. But, of course, this was what was true of Bernie Madoff all along, was they had a lot of people handing their money over to feeders who then handed it over to Madoff. And a lot of these people didn't know where it was being invested. They didn't really ask. I mean, one of the astounding things in all of this is how willing people are to give their money off to strangers.
Well, and when they're getting 17-18% returns, as these guys were getting, you don't tend to ask too many questions, do you?
Well, but you should. And even though Madoff had a stellar reputation, you should ask hard questions. I mean, every good con man has a great reputation. That's how they con.
This guy in the program this evening, Bienes, was he a con man, do you think?
Well, he conned himself, and Madoff conned him. He didn't ask hard questions. He said in the interview, look, if I had, I don't know how you split an atom. I know you can split one, but I don't know how you do it, and I don't know how an airplane flies. And I asked him if he ever asked Madoff what he was doing, and he said, yeah, it was something about arbitrage between stocks and bonds and blah, 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 blah. He had this sort of attitude that that didn't matter. So he'd conned himself into believing that those 20%, 18% returns was all I need to know.
Do you think that belief that he had, that conning of himself, made it easier to go out and get people to invest in what he really, probably in his heart of hearts, had to have known was a gimmick?
You know, in the interview, I pressed him on that. I said, do you feel any remorse or any regret for having led all these people to the trough? But he says he feels no remorse.
Yeah, well, there's actually a great piece of tape that we'll play here of you asking him if he really had any regrets.
So what do you say to the people that are watching this, that got involved in this through you and Frank, and who are angry, feel like they were misled, feel that they've been violated, wrong.
I didn't violate them. Madoff did. Focus on who was the perpetrator.
Fact is, though, that none of this works without these feeder funds.
That's right. These people enabled Bernie Madoff to collect the kind of money he did. And it kept Bernie, in a way, insulated from the clients. Madoff wasn't such a social butterfly as people imagine, even though he was a member of all these clubs. He let these other people gather the money. So they couldn't have done it without him.
What happens now to Michael Bienes and everybody else who ran these funds for Madoff? Madoff obviously is going to jail for a long time. What about the rest of these guys?
Well, there are a lot of lawsuits flying around. As far as I know, Bienes has not yet been sued. There are people thinking about it. But there's a lot of investigation yet to come. And there's also his family, Madoff's family, his sons, his brother, his wife, who are still the subject, going to be the subject of investigations going forward.
Any reason to believe that this won't happen again sometime? Well, people will once more not ask the hard questions?
Well, Madoff has set a record here in terms of length and size. So I don't know that anybody is going to be able to come forward with something of this scale, certainly not in the near future.
Frontline tonight on PBS is called The Madoff Affair. Martin Smith is one of the reporters on that series. Martin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, college students sketch out a colorful future.
If you're a young doodler and tinkerer, take heart. You're living in a career candy store filled with cool jobs your parents and career counselors probably don't even know exist.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was all ups and downs on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gained 0.6%, 50 points, closed at 8,469. The NASDAQ lost 0.8%, 15 points, finished at 1715. The S&P 500 closed slightly lower at 907. Financial companies continued to bleed today. Bank of New York Mellon stock dropped 3.75% after the bank sold more than $1 billion worth of new shares. J.P. Morgan Chase chased away 1.33%. American Express lost 2.25%. Both Bank of America and Citigroup fell more than 5% today. So where was the good news, I hear you ask? Pfizer pulled up more than 5% after analysts said the company could boost its dividend after taking over Wyeth. Merck gained more than 2%. Microsoft climbed nearly 3%. Bonds traded pretty much flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note holding steady at 3.17%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for April. National Police Week continues with a candlelight vigil at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. And if you're in France, the Cannes Film Festival opens. French actress Isabelle Huppert is the president of the jury this year. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's probably a pretty specific set of images that pops into your mind when you hear the phrase, the American dream. A house in the suburbs, a steady job, a better future for your kids probably too. At the very least, this recession has made Americans a little less sure about whether they can ever have that dream. So we're going to spend some time this week looking at how it might be changing. For years, a college education was the first stepping stone to a well-paying job and a bright future. Today, as we begin our series, The Next American Dream, we head to California State University, Long Beach, where more than a third of the students are the first in their families to go to college. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner tells us that that college stepping stone might not be as rock solid as it used to be.
Hector Torres grew up in the San Joaquin Valley, watching his parents and other Mexican immigrants toil in California's multi-billion dollar farm industry.
And for me to live through that and see generations and generations get stuck at the same level, at the same job, it motivated me to know that I can step away from that.
Torres did step away. He's now a sophomore majoring in microbiology. Torres was valedictorian at his high school and won a prestigious scholarship to Cal State Long Beach. But when he arrived on campus, he immediately sensed he needed to up his game.
It's a very big campus. And I thought about it, if I'm competing here, I wonder what's the level of competition in a private university. I have to be on top of everything.
Torres is right to be worried. College tuition is going up, job opportunities are down, and more Americans are going to college now than ever before. Employers today have the luxury of choosing the 4.0s over the 3.5s. Torres says he plans to take an extra year to get his degree so he can keep up his grades. He says he's reading and studying more than he did his freshman year, and he talks about needing that extra edge.
I think in order to now have a strong resume and go into the workforce, at least a master's, because now bachelor's doesn't make it anymore.
Turns out Torres is right, and he's wrong. A BA still makes it in the sense that college grads earn about 75% more than high school graduates. That's called the college wage premium. Patrick Callen is president of the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education.
Never before has education beyond high school been so important to the American dream.
But that college premium is high, partly because the earnings of the folks who don't go to college are so low. Economists say a bachelor's degree is no longer the ticket to middle-class security that it once was, and the college wage premium has actually plateaued over the past 8 years. MIT's David Auder says technology and globalization may be eroding the value of some college-level jobs, like accounting, stockbroking, and sales.
Many types of even low-level positions, some of them can actually be done by computers, and others can be done in other countries. So some of those things may actually be putting some pressure on the wages of moderately skilled college grads.
PhDs, doctors, and lawyers, on the other hand, are doing fine. But not everyone's cut out for graduate studies or med school. Cal State Long Beach knows this and tries to advise its students on how to get that extra edge with a BA alone. Marilee Samuelson is head of academic advising here. She counsels kids to hone their writing and speaking skills, take internships, and add what she calls meat to their degrees.
We want them to do minors, and we want them to do certificates. So as an example, if we're talking to an art major, we might suggest that they do a marketing minor or a philosophy major. We might say that human resource management might be a good minor for them.
So, a graduate conversant in Plato and collective bargaining. And those certificates she mentioned, those are sort of real-world electives, like technical writing. Melvin Lopez is among those taking Samuelson's advice.
I'm 20 years old, and I'm majoring in criminal justice with a minor in communications.
Lopez works part-time to help support his parents. Both are from El Salvador. He grew up in a neighborhood scarred by gangs and drugs, and now he dreams of law school and a career as a prosecutor.
There's a lot of people from the neighborhood come from that they're comfortable with where they're at. They don't see that they need to better themselves or live I would say more like a stable life. And I see myself, you know, living a more productive life.
Once upon a time, there were three little pigs.
Lopez is taking a storytelling class to cultivate his speaking skills. Prosecutors, after all, have to think fast on their feet and tell a good story. Today, he gets to play the bad guy in a fairy tale improv.
And I will puff, and I'll huff, and I'll blow your house down. Tasty bacon.
Lopez hopes his communications minor will broaden his opportunities after graduation, just in case he can't swing law school.
If law school doesn't work out, I've thought about maybe doing some counseling because, you know, there's always, you know, the need to have counselors in schools and stuff like that.
Well, maybe in a good economy anyway. Lopez is optimistic things will turn around, but he's also a realist. He's keeping his American dream in check.
I hope to, you know, have a house and live a stable financial life. I'm not planning on being filthy rich or anything like that, but I just want to live a life where I don't have to worry about the things that my parents have had to worry about.
Things like paying medical bills and next month's rent. In Long Beach, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If it's not a straight bachelor's degree, then what might be the best education to help somebody realize the next American dream? Consider two equally bright but completely different high school seniors. One's the captain of the debate team with straight A's. She's on her way to Yale. The other's a B student who'd rather draw than study. Commentator Kay Heimowitz says design is the economic engine of tomorrow.
If you're a young doodler and tinkerer, take heart. You're living in a career candy store filled with cool jobs your parents and career counselors probably don't even know exist. As consumers demand more for their money, design has moved from a decorative sideshow to center stage in the business world. How do you distinguish your washing machine or MP3 player from the crowds of other washing machines and MP3 players? Steve Jobs sure knew the answer. Good design. But the new design economy isn't just about industrial, graphic, or set designers anymore. Now there are animators, computer user interface, video game, and even infographic designers. They turn complex data into intuitive visual displays like clouds of popular words on websites and interactive maps of everything from traffic patterns to the spread of swine flu. Ever heard of a design anthropologist like the specialists Microsoft sends out to developing countries to see how people use technology? How about an experiential designer? That's someone who shows businesses how to improve the sensory and emotive experience of their product. New York firm ESI, for instance, refitted Best Buy's echoing warehouses into a series of appealing, village-like, interactive spaces. Labor Department statisticians have yet to catch up, but design trade groups say they have seen big jumps in their ranks. AIGA, the Professional Association for Design, for instance, notes a tripling in the number of graphic and multimedia designers since 1990. Over 40 new design trade schools have opened in the past 15 years. It's true that workers in the design economy are hurting right now like everybody else, but that's no reason to become an accountant. Good design is no longer a luxury. It's creating better value and simpler ways to understand a more complex world. The right people for these jobs tend to be resourceful, independent workers, always finding new problems to solve and new niches to explore. If that sounds like you, think design. Remember, a good right brain is a terrible thing to waste.
Kay Heimowitz is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also contributing editor of City Journal. Tomorrow on The Next American Dream, that house with the white picket fence might not be for everybody. To hear other American Public Media programs in this series, you can check our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, diehard New York Yankee fans can now own a piece of baseball history. The team announced a deal with the city today that'll let the Yankees sell off the contents of the old stadium, everything from sod and seats to foul poles. But the best Yankee anecdote today is in the New York Post. The paper suggests that rather than shell out $5,000 for two of the best seats in the new billion-dollar Yankee stadium to see, say, the Seattle Mariners, you could fly to Seattle, stay in a hotel for a couple of days, have a couple of really nice dinners, watch two games, fly back, and still save yourself more than $2,000. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 50 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ fell 15, about 0.8%. The S&P 500 traded pretty much flat. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on the program, sometimes plans don't work out like you'd expect.
We got married, and then we bought a house, and then we had a baby, and...
and then the whole world fell apart.
Home ownership and the next American dream. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.